Hello and welcome to the Deathcast. I'm your host, author, and journalist Ian Tott, and I'd like to thank you for joining me as we're prepared to take our fourth look at the crimes of Joseph Paul Franklin. Before we get going, as always, I have the normal show notes. If you'd like to follow me on social media, just search for Deathcast, Deathcast Pod, or Deathcast Official. If you'd like to help support the show, there's a couple of ways you can do this. First and foremost, you can go to your favorite podcast app, leave a 5-star review, and follow the show. You can also go to tinyurl.com/dcast. Patreon, where for as little as $1.99 a month, you can get access to early ad-free shows, just as Channel and Anthony have done, as have the largest monthly contributors to this show, Samantha and Debbie. Again, that's tinyurl.com/dcast, Patreon, where you can get access to early ad-free shows and exclusive content. All right, now that all of that's out of the way, find yourself a nice comfy chair, kick back and relax. I've got my coffee. I've got my cigarettes. Let's go into the crypt. We left off last week with Joseph Paul Franklin on the run from federal and state authorities in 1980. While we were looking back at who Joseph Paul Franklin was. Specifically, we left off where Joseph Paul Franklin legally changed his name to Joseph Paul Franklin. This was on September 21st, 1976. Now, as with most serial murderers, Franklin was a habitual liar who gave different reasons as to why he changed his name. Some have it for wanting to take the name of Goebbels and Benjamin Franklin. Some people he told it was because he had discovered his real father's name and wanted to take the man's name. His sister Caroline said that it was because he wanted to distance himself as much as possible from his father. While a jailhouse informant later stated that Franklin informed him he changed his name because his legal birth name had a prison record attached to it, and he envisioned traveling to Rhodesia so that he could join the Rhodesian armed forces, as to Franklin, this would give him carte blanche to murder blacks. This same individual further stated that Franklin had fantastical ideas as to what this would entail. According to this man, Franklin believed that he would just be able to walk down the street and execute blacks with impunity whenever he encountered them. As for what precipitated his crime spree, Franklin stated that not having any real legal repercussions for his assaults on black and white couples in Maryland, specifically macing a couple, as well as being thrown out of a rooming house that he was living in, really pushed him over the edge. To quote him, quote, "Do some killing, couldn't get a job, was going to pay some Jews back for it." There's also the fact that Franklin had become severely disillusioned with the various white supremacist organizations that he was involved with, namely the KKK and the American Nazi Party and its various offshoots. So with all of this, his simmering rage and hatred for individuals who were different from him, Franklin began putting together a plan in his mind of a nationwide crime spree where he would strike and then vanish, killing individuals and then leaving few, if any, clues as he fled the area. Franklin's first known acts of extreme violence took place in 1977, not with shootings, but with bombings, a tactic that had been employed by hate groups in the southern United States for decades. Now, before Franklin could begin this campaign of terror, he realized that he needed to have funding, something independent from a job which would tie him to any specific place. So he turned to bank robbery, something that he had fantasized about doing for years. Franklin was inspired by individuals like Jesse James, Billy the Kid, John Dillinger, Bonnie and Clyde. His first known bank robbery took place on June 16th, 1977 in Atlanta. While there's not a whole lot of information out there concerning this robbery, we know that Franklin got away with it fairly easily and afterwards began the first of numerous changes to his appearance, cutting his hair, dyeing it, purchasing brand new clothing and new prescription eyewear before disappearing into the background. In this regard, although Ted Bundy is often referred to as a chameleon killer, Franklin really perfected this, as in addition to changing his physical appearance, Franklin also took on various aliases, including William Quantros, Joe Price, Michael Larson, Ed Logan, Francis Nichols, etc., etc. This was entirely done to make the identity of the individual responsible for these bank robberies and later murders virtually impossible to discern. Now, on July 5th, 1977, Joseph Paul Franklin purchased 50 pounds of explosives from a distributor in Charleston, South Carolina, before heading back to the Maryland area. Franklin later stated that his target in this particular attack was an individual by the name of Morris Amity, who was a leader in the Jewish community as well as a lobbyist. At roughly 3 a.m. on Monday, July 25th, 1977, Franklin approached the Amity home located at 47010 Sunflower Drive in the Flower Valley subdivision of Rockville. Amity lived in the house with his wife and three children, and although there had been threats against his life in the past, he had no reason to suspect that anyone was currently targeting him. We know that Franklin placed the dynamite on the front stoop of the Amity home, ran an extension cord from the bomb onto a neighboring street, and then attached it to a detonator. The force of the explosion ripped one wall of the house down, lifted roofs off homes nearby, but remarkably did not injure anyone inside of the Amity home beyond the family's beagle puppy named Bingo, who was found dead downstairs. Now, the time of the explosion is given as being precisely 3:20 a.m., and responders later stated that the bombing was the worst explosion that they had ever seen. And although the ATF and FBI soon became involved in the investigation, as the bomber had left no clues, they were stumped as to who could be responsible for the crime. And the case is going to very quickly go cold. Some members of law enforcement were of the opinion that the bombing was the act of a professional, while others thought that it more likely than not that the individual responsible was in fact a novice at bombings, as some ATF agents later stated, a professional would have completely destroyed the house and everyone inside. While the case does go cold quickly, police did have a lead. Individuals saw a car speeding away from the scene. However, when the car was located, it was found to contain three individuals who were later determined to not have been involved in the crime. They also were unable to discern whether or not the act had been intended to kill or whether it was simply an intimidation tactic, although Franklin later did state that he didn't intend to kill Amity and his family. He just believed that he had placed the explosive device in the wrong location, and that if he had simply gone around to the back of the house and placed the dynamite, he would have killed everyone inside. While members of the Nazi party that Franklin was involved with were incited about this attack, Franklin kept his involvement in this crime to himself, as he reasoned that if anyone knew he was responsible for these crimes, it could lead to his capture and imprisonment. In this regard, Joseph Paul Franklin was different from a lot of white supremacists who tend to brag about the crimes that they have committed against minorities to one another. Franklin just simply kept his mouth shut, acted as though, you know, he was just as surprised as anyone else, and when it became apparent that the police had no leads that could bring them to his doorstep, Franklin simply vanished, heading for Chattanooga, Tennessee, where he knew that there was a large Jewish population. Where in July of 1977, Franklin would target the Beth Shalom Synagogue. Now, this synagogue, which had been built in 1958, had a crawl space beneath it, which Franklin was able to access on the night of July 29th, where he placed an explosive made from dynamite. As he had in Maryland, Franklin attached extension cords to this device, which led from beneath the synagogue to the room he had rented at the Airport Inn, not very far away. It's interesting to note that although Franklin used extension cords, this particular explosive had a timer on it. Unbeknownst to him, however, the majority of the membership of this synagogue had left that Friday's service early. So that by the time the bomb went off, completely destroying the structure at 9 p.m., no one was inside. While his attack was successful in terms of a terror campaign, it did not have the desired effect that Franklin was looking for, in that it did not take the lives of anyone inside of the building. He later lamented, quote, "Got mixed on times and set it to go off at the wrong time. If I would have set it an hour earlier, I would have killed them all, and I was trying to kill them all," unquote. As with his prior bombing, there was very little to go on in terms of who was responsible, although because the ATF was involved, they very quickly realized that it was almost certain that the same individual or individuals was responsible for this attack. And while they shared information amongst one another, nothing really came of it. We know that Franklin robbed two more banks after this bombing, one in Georgia, one in Ohio. And somewhere along the way, he steals a rifle before heading to Madison, Wisconsin, where he intended to target a judge by the name of Archie Simonson, who, in Franklin's opinion, had been too lenient on black males who had been convicted of rape. Franklin arrives in the capital city on August 6th, 1977, registering one of the many motels in the city as John Wesley Hardin. However, his plans changed the next day, August 7th, when Franklin encountered an interracial couple, Alphonse Manning Jr. and Tony Schwen, both 23 years old. As the story goes, Franklin was at the East Town Mall when Manning pulled in and, in Franklin's point of view, blocked him in. However, this is more likely than not just an excuse that Franklin had devised to carry through with his plan. Franklin later said that Manning approached his car as Franklin yelled at him from the driver's seat, and Franklin pulled out his handgun and opened fire. Quote, "Just whip out that pistol, boom, you know, got him right there in the midsection." After this, Franklin exited the car, ran toward Manning's vehicle where Tony Schwen was sitting, and, quote, "There she was. She was staring straight at me in the face, looking like she was trying to recognize me, you know? So I just put the big barrel up there again with one hand, you know, and went pow, shot her right in the back." Running back to his car, the black cowboy hat that Franklin was wearing fell off of his head. However, he was unable to retrieve it, and unbeknownst to him, a witness saw this entire thing and years later would pick Franklin out of a photo lineup as the perpetrator of this attack. Now, unfortunately, Manning and Schwen both died from their wounds at the scene. When discussing the crimes later, he stated he had committed them, quote, "The spur of the moment. I hadn't planned it. I just whipped out my pistol and shot him right there." Further stating, quote, "It just happened to be two people that I totally hated, so I didn't dislike it. Once began having sex with blacks in my mind, as steeped as I was in that, they weren't even human." Franklin also compared himself to Samson, stating that blacks were his Philistines, and he believed that it was God's destiny and mission for him to not only kill interracial couples, but also to start a race war. When describing his killings of interracial couples, Franklin went on to recount, quote, "If you shoot the black man first, the woman would just stay by his side like a dumb fucking idiot. It's the funniest thing. It happened every time." He also stated that this was a lesson he carried from this first known killing. However, it is quite possible that there are other murders that Franklin carried out around this point in time and in the subsequent years that we simply know nothing about. We see how this particular murder was carried out spur of the moment. It's a very real possibility that there are others just like this out there that have never been tied to Joseph Paul Franklin. Prosecutors would later come to believe that Franklin may have become sexually aroused by the act of killing, with one prosecutor stating that Franklin became quote-unquote weird when the topic of sex was brought up to him. However, the prosecutor never really elaborated on what they meant by the word weird. After leaving Wisconsin, Franklin's movements are really unknown until exactly a month later, when he arrives in Little Rock, Arkansas on September 7th of 1977, where he robs a bank before heading to Dallas, Texas, where Franklin stated he planned to purchase more weaponry, which he did. We know that Franklin purchased a 30-06 from a man in Irving, Texas, and by his own accounts, he honed his rifle skills further than it had been honed in the National Guard by taking the gun to a shooting range where he spent hours perfecting his shot, as well as adjusting the telescopic sight to a place that Franklin felt confident he would be able to hit his targets easily. Franklin's MO at this point is largely the same as it would be in later years, staying in a city for a week or two, moving from hotel to hotel and registering under different names. At some point in mid-September, Franklin drove to Oklahoma City, where he planned on bombing another synagogue. However, he later told authorities that after arriving in Oklahoma City, he realized that his chances of finding a suitable target inside of that city were very low, and he decided to head for St. Louis instead. Along the way, he decides to alter his plan, choosing instead to employ an ambush sniper attack as opposed to a bombing. We know that by October 7th, Franklin was in St. Louis inside of a hotel room and looking for suitable targets in the local phone book, eventually settling on the Brith Shalom Knesset Israel congregation in Richmond Heights. Franklin stated to police later that he chose this particular synagogue because there was a hill across the street, and he believed it made the perfect sniper's perch for which to carry out his crime. Prior to carrying out the assault, Franklin purchased a number of items, including a box of 10-inch nails, a bicycle, and a guitar case to carry his weapon in. The reason he brought the bicycle was Franklin hoped to keep witnesses from seeing the car he was driving as he made his escape. Prior to the actual committing of the crime, Franklin ground the serial number off of the rifle, cleaning the weapon as well as the ammunition to ensure that there was no dirt or fingerprints on anything that could be linked back to him. One thing Franklin had taken to doing during his time on the road was listening to CB radio chatter. Franklin did this in order to get a bead on the police. Using the handle of Bushwhacker, he would talk to local truckers to find out where police were located at, so he could not only plan the commission of his crime, but also his getaway. In later years, he would take to using a police scanner to actually listen in on police calls to get a better idea of where the police were situated while he committed a crime and made his getaway. On Friday, October 7th, Franklin rode his bicycle to the synagogue and hammered two nails into a nearby telephone pole, which he planned to use as a gun rest. He placed socks over the nails to hide them before stashing the guitar case that held his rifle inside some nearby bushes. The following morning, October 8th, Franklin drove to the synagogue, parked his car, and then proceeded on his bicycle to the area he had prepared for his sniper assault. As stated, Franklin was an extremely meticulous planner. He had researched the times of service at this particular synagogue and discovered that a bar mitzvah was taking place, and that those inside the synagogue would begin leaving at around 1 p.m. So as he hid up in the knoll of trees across the street from the synagogue, Franklin spent his time checking and rechecking his weapon along with his watch, as well as looking around to ensure that nobody had spotted him, particularly any police officers who might be in the area. At just after 1 p.m., roughly 40 people exited the synagogue. as Franklin later stated, quote, "As soon as they came out, I opened fire. I hit two. I wanted to kill at least two of them. After the first two shots, I fired three quick shots randomly at the synagogue. Two individuals end up being hit by Franklin's shots. Obviously, a scene of mass pandemonium breaks out. Witnesses later told police that children ran into the synagogue screaming that someone had opened fire on them and that people were dying outside. Gerald Gordon, a 42-year-old man who would later die from his injuries. Two others were also wounded, Stephen Goldman and William Ash. It was later reported that Gordon, the man who perished, was in the process of getting into his car on the north side of the building when he was hit in the chest. Franklin, for his part, put the gun back into the guitar case, put it into the bushes, and then rode his bicycle to the parking lot where his car was parked. After hiding the bicycle in another strand of bushes, Franklin got into his car and left St. Louis, heading for Memphis, Tennessee. And although he did take a life, Franklin was angry that he had not killed more people that day, lamenting the fact that he had not killed a person for each bullet fired. Police very quickly found the rifle that Franklin had used, as well as five spent cartridges across the street from the synagogue, and it wasn't long before they found the bicycle which Franklin had discarded. Lieutenant Thomas Bullich later said to the media, quote, "We are working on a lot of angles, beating the bushes to try and come up with something. At this point, we have nothing concrete, no suspects." Despite Franklin's meticulous planning, he had been seen, and the description given of him by witnesses to police had him at white male, 19, 25 years old, 5 feet 6 inches tall, with a medium to thin build, high cheekbones, acne, wearing a green army surplus coat and blue jeans with frayed cuffs. Police were also able to retrieve the serial number from the rifle used in this killing, despite Franklin's attempts to destroy it, and were able to trace the weapon back to the man Franklin had purchased the gun from in Texas. However, the name Franklin had used to purchase the weapon ends up being a dead end for authorities. And Franklin realized as he was leaving St. Louis that he had made a major mistake in leaving the weapon. He later told authorities that at this point he made a decision that he would never leave a weapon behind after committing one of his acts of violence, as he realized that despite his best efforts, there was still the possibility that it could in fact be traced back to him, and that was not a risk that he could take. He also decided that he would no longer target anyone from the Jewish community, knowing that police more likely than not were in talks with authorities in Washington and had figured out that someone was bombing and targeting the Jewish community, particularly synagogues, and that it was more likely than not the very same individual. As for Franklin, he spends the remainder of the year driving around the South and along the Eastern Seaboard, robbing banks, possibly committing further murders that we know nothing about. However, Franklin was notoriously tight-lipped about these periods of time during which no known crimes were committed. We do know that in February of 1978, Franklin returned to Atlanta intent on shooting an interracial couple, eventually settling on 22-year-old Johnny Brookshire and his girlfriend, 23-year-old Joy Williams. Brookshire ends up dying from his wounds. Joy Williams ends up surviving, although she is paralyzed for the rest of her life from the waist down. However, it needs to be noted that although Franklin, he was never officially charged with this particular crime. As with this crime, the next crime that Franklin confessed to cannot be confirmed. Not that it can't be confirmed to have happened, but we cannot confirm with 100% certainty whether or not it was actually Joseph Paul Franklin who committed the crime. We'll be back in just a moment.
Hey there, my D&Ders. This is your old buddy Ian here with a brand new sponsor this week. Now, you've all heard me talk about Chinese teachers in the past. I have never promoted a Chinese teacher quite like Chinese teacher Evian. Evian is a sweet, honest, and dedicated teacher who teaches every day. She not only makes certain that her students understand the differences in tonal pronunciation, she allows them the opportunity to get up during the class and read what it is that she is teaching so that each student knows that they are getting the best possible education and is pronouncing the words and tones correctly. So I'd like you to do right now is go to tinyurl.com/EvianCT and check her out. That's tinyurl.com/EvianCT. She makes learning this beautiful and wonderful language a lot of fun. And remember, Mandarin Chinese is the fastest growing language in the international job market today. This is the language that you want to learn if you don't want to work that boring 9-to-5 job, but you want to get a foothold in a company that has an international presence. They're all looking for Mandarin speakers, so let Evian be the one to introduce you to this language. You won't be disappointed.
Hey there, D&Ders, your friend Ian here with another brand new sponsor this week, Artwork by Katie. Now, as the son of a fairly successful artist, I grew up around the art world, saw many different styles of art. I know good art from bad, and I can honestly say that in addition to being a good friend, Katie is one of the best artists I have ever had the pleasure of seeing. Her works of art, be it drawings or paintings, are absolutely amazing. And Katie doesn't just do original works of art, she also does commission pieces. So if you're looking for that perfect piece of art to offset the decor in your home, office, or even in your place of business, go check out Artwork by Katie at linktr.ee/KatieArtworks. That's linktr.ee/KatieArtworks. You'll be blown away. On March 6th, 1978, pornographic magazine and later film distributor and publisher Larry Flint was in Lawrenceville, Georgia, fighting an obscenity charge leveled against him for one of the Hustler magazines that he had published. During a break in court proceedings, Flint and his lawyer, a local individual by the name of Gene Reeves, left the courthouse intending to go get lunch, unaware that, according to his own statements, Joseph Paul Franklin was in the window of a building across the street, waiting for Flint to appear. As Franklin later stated, he was enraged at Larry Flint for publishing pictorials of interracial couples inside of his magazine Hustler, and he believed that Larry Flint was one of the leading causes in the United States of interracial couples becoming so popular. We do know that at 12:20 p.m., Sarah Hutchins, a part-time worker at the courthouse, received a phone call informing her, quote, "Tell solicitor Gary Davis he doesn't have to worry about Larry Flint anymore. Jesus has taken a hand in it." According to Hutchins, she placed the caller on hold, determined to go and find the prosecutor, only to find that the caller had hung up. She told police that moments later she heard the sound of sirens out in the street. At this point in time, Larry Flint had received numerous threats on his life from individuals who were enraged with the materials that he was making, going so far as to install high fences around his various properties, as well as hiring bodyguards. If you listen to the series I did on the murder of Roy Radin, you'll recall that guest and friend of the show, Ed Opperman, came on to talk about the Radin murder, and we had a discussion about Larry Flint, particularly the various bodyguards that Flint was known to employ, many of whom were said to have been contract killers, and at least two of whom were arrested and jailed for life for the murder of Roy Radin. So Flint was no stranger to both controversy and violence at this point in time. Flint stated that on this day, March 6, 1978, he had no fear of any form of violence, as he had discovered that the people of Lawrenceville were extremely friendly, and because of this, he had dismissed his bodyguards for the day. However, according to Joseph Paul Franklin, he had been following Flint for some period of time, having twice stalked the man in Ohio. After eating lunch, Flint and his lawyer exited the cafe which they had gone to, and Joseph Paul Franklin immediately opened fire with what police later concluded was a Marlin Deer rifle that shot 44 magnum loads. Flint was shot twice, once in the stomach, once in the side, while his lawyer took off down the street before he himself collapsed, having been hit twice, once in the arm and once in the stomach. Police have no leads in this particular case, nor can anyone surmise where the shots had originated from, although police later conclude that the most likely location was an abandoned hotel located directly across the street from both the courthouse and the diner. Both men are rushed to a hospital where they undergo emergency surgery. Reeves ends up spending 20 days in a coma and eventually makes a full recovery. Flint, on the other hand, is a different matter. Half of his stomach and his spleen are removed, while his liver requires repair. Almost 3 feet of his intestines needs to be removed as well. One of the bullets that had hit Larry Flint went in through his stomach, I believe, and hit him in the spine. Doctors doubted that he would survive. As usual, Flint was his normal brazen self, telling reporters that he planned fully to recover and walk again, stating, quote, "I'm going to walk again. They're giving me a 50-50 chance, but I'm going to walk again. They gave me a 2% chance to live when I was shot. I could walk out of here tomorrow if it wasn't for my legs." Now, in addition to this, Flint also has an infection inside of his body caused by the rupturing of his intestines. So, although he ends up being moved to a hospital in Atlanta, Larry Flint's condition remains critical for some period of time. Larry Flint would never walk again, and for the remainder of his life would be confined to a wheelchair. And although no one has ever been criminally charged in the assassination attempt of Larry Flynt, some in law enforcement consider the case closed with the confession of Joseph Paul Franklin. However, from much of his life, at least according to statements Larry Flynt gave to the media, he believed that the CIA and FBI was behind the attempted assassination on his life. Flynt himself could be a Patreon series, considering all of the rather distasteful individuals that he was associated with throughout his life. After the shooting, Joseph Paul Franklin fled the area. In his own words, he felt like he was a complete failure over his inability to murder Larry Flynt, stating, quote, "I was wishing later that I actually fired, you know, emptied the gun, actually fired all 6 or 7 rounds at him, but I thought at the time he was already dead. It was one of the first snipings I had committed, so I was not that good then, but if I'd done that 2 or 3 years later, I would have just, he would have been history." Franklin has said that he was also disappointed that the media did not pick up on the fact that all of these crimes were an attempt to start a race war, and this is in contradiction to other statements that he said, where he talked about the fact that he was trying to remain undiscovered. And some believe that these statements about being upset concerning the media's lack of linking these stories together comes from this innate need that serial killers have to be recognized for the crimes that they have committed. Franklin did walk from this shooting with a new resolve, however, and that is that he would fire as many rounds as he possibly could during the course of an attack in an attempt to ensure that a victim died and was not simply paralyzed. Franklin proceeded to Chattanooga after the attempted assassination of Larry Flynt before making his way to Louisville, Kentucky, where on April 11th, 1978, he robbed a bank. He's known to have robbed another bank in Atlanta, Georgia on July 25th, and a third bank in Montgomery, Alabama on August 12th. In between these two bank robberies, however, Franklin returned once more to Chattanooga, Tennessee, this time armed with a 12-gauge shotgun. On July 29th of 1978, Franklin was driving past a Pizza Hut when he saw an interracial couple inside. Taking the shotgun from his car, Franklin hid in a tall section of grass by the parking lot and waited for the couple to come out. As the man Bryant Tatum came out of the restaurant with his girlfriend Nancy Diane Hilton, Franklin opened fire from the grass, shooting just once at Tatum, killing him instantly before turning the gun on Tatum's girlfriend. While Nancy Hilton would survive her injuries, she was unable to provide police with any useful information, such as a description of the man who had opened fire on them from the grass. After this, Franklin returns to Montgomery, Alabama, where, under the assumed name of James A. Cooper, he rents a small apartment. And it's while he's in Montgomery, he meets a 16-year-old by the name of Anita Carden in an ice cream shop. The two began dating, and eventually, in January of 1979, the two are going to be married. Now, Anita states that on numerous occasions during the courtship, Franklin would leave for a few days or a few weeks at a time, returning with large sums of money. And while she never explicitly stated that Franklin told her he got this money from bank robberies, police have stated that they believe almost certainly that this is what Franklin was doing, given his now known criminal history. After their marriage, Anita and Franklin drive around southern United States throughout the rest of January and February. It's during this period that Anita discovered two things. Her husband was prone to fits of tantrum-like rage, during which he was known to smash hotel furniture as well as punch holes in the walls, and also that she had become pregnant. Anita stated that she believed Joseph Paul Franklin was in fact a plumber who traveled around the South working, and that his name was in fact James A. Cooper. Anita's family stated that despite any misgivings they may have had about her new husband, he could also be very kind to them and generous, lavishing every member of the family with gifts at various points, particularly Anita's brother, whom Franklin purchased a motorcycle for. We know that after returning from their honeymoon, the couple rented a duplex where Franklin was said to grow a garden. In April, Franklin left Anita, heading to Nashville, and robbed two banks. This continued on, with Franklin robbing numerous banks over the course of the next few months, always returning to Anita with massive amounts of money. Franklin appears to have gone through a considerable cooling off period after the shooting of Bryant Tatum and his girlfriend, which is not uncommon with serial killers, as anyone who's listened to this show or other true crime shows is well aware of. They go through a cooling off period before the idea, the obsession to kill, returns once again and they have to act it out. There are also mitigating factors that can affect a serial killer's propensity to kill, such as changes in life circumstances. Franklin had many of these. It's rather apparent from interviews I've read with him that he had no intention of meeting a woman and getting married after he committed the murder of Bryant Tatum, but it seemed to just happen. This is one of those mitigating circumstances. He has a new wife. They're enjoying their time together. They are moving around, going various places together. Because of this, because Franklin is constantly busy and is attempting now to provide for his wife and soon-to-be-born child, the need to kill while still there is not as all-consuming as it was in the past. This would change, however, in July of 1979, when Franklin drove to Doraville, Georgia. Doraville is a suburb of Atlanta, so it was a fairly integrated city at this point in time. As he's driving down the street, Franklin sees a black man by the name of Harold McIver. McIver was the manager of a Taco Bell, and what Franklin saw was the man speaking to white women, which Franklin assumed to be in a flirtatious manner. So according to Franklin, he parked his car, retrieved a .30-30 rifle from the trunk of the vehicle, and positioned himself in a wooded area that was roughly 150 feet from the parking lot. Not long after this, MacGyver exited the restaurant and headed towards his car, at which point Franklin opens fire, shooting 29-year-old Harold MacGyver twice, killing him instantly. Franklin was on the move almost instantly, arriving in Falls Church, Virginia on August 8th. Arriving at a Burger King, Franklin saw a man by the name of Raymond Taylor sitting at a table eating his dinner. At roughly 9:50 p.m., customers later stated to police that they heard a loud explosion and the sound of Taylor was taken to a nearby hospital where he was pronounced dead on arrival. Joseph Paul Franklin quickly fled the scene. On August 25th of 1979, Franklin called his wife Anita to learn that he had become a father to a baby girl. Franklin returns to Montgomery, where he spends a few weeks, although this is to be the last point in time that Franklin and Anita are going to spend any considerable period together. We know that he and Anita will end up separating roughly 7 months from this point in time as Franklin's mania begins to spiral out of control. For the time being, however, he is giving up the appearance of being a devoted father and husband who works as a traveling plumber. The arrival of Franklin's daughter into the world does nothing to satiate his need to kill. On Sunday, October 21st, Franklin arrives in Oklahoma City, finding a shopping center not far from the Oklahoma State Fairgrounds, where he was able to find a perch from which to shoot his next intended victim. At 5 p.m., 42-year-old Jesse Taylor was returning from dropping his three children off at a hula hoop competition. His wife, 31-year-old Marion Van Bresset, was in the car along with their three children. On the way home, the couple decided to stop at a supermarket and get groceries. Franklin saw them pull in, saw Taylor exit the car and head into the grocery store, and as Taylor made his way back to the vehicle, groceries in hands, Franklin opened fire. He was estimated to be about 195 feet from where the Taylor family was situated. Taylor was hit, thrown against the car, and then more shots began to ring out. A 16-year-old witness later told authorities that she heard Taylor moaning, "No, no, no." Taylor's wife rushes to his aid, kneeling over his body, and is immediately hit in the chest by a blast. Both husband and wife died at the scene as Franklin fled, unconcerned with the fact that three small children were sitting inside of the car and had watched their parents die brutally in front of them. Again, police have no suspects. However, they do recover shell casings from a grove of trees across the street from the parking lot of the shopping center. Franklin next heads down to DeKalb County, Georgia, and along the way, he picks up a hitchhiker, a 15-year-old by the name of Mercedes Lynn Masters. The two of them very quickly form a friendship that then becomes a sexual relationship. This, however, quickly dissolves when Masters informs Franklin that she has had sexual relations with African-American men. On December 5th, 1979, Joseph Paul Franklin and Masters drive out to a wooded area where Franklin shoots Masters with a 12-gauge shotgun. He later said, quote, maybe it had something to do with the fact that I had sex with her first. And when she told me she had sex with a black dude, then things changed. Then I decided to kill her. If I found any woman who had dated black guys, to kill them, you know, if I had any woman in the car who told me she had dated black, she was history. Her death was real gruesome. You can imagine what damage will do. It's interesting to note that Masters' picture was one of many that would later be discovered when Joseph Paul Franklin is arrested prior to his fleeing to Georgia, inside of a scrapbook where there were pictures of multiple nude women posing with his guns. Some in law enforcement would later speculate that the majority of these women were more likely than not dead, as none of them could be found. If law enforcement is right, Franklin may have killed prostitutes as a way to satiate his murderous desires in between the killings of his intended targets, interracial couples. And he may have simply used the excuse that they confessed to him that they had dated a black man as a reason for justifying, maybe not only to law enforcement, but also to himself, why he targeted them. As we know, prostitutes are heavily targeted by serial killers as they are an extremely at-risk group with few friends or family available to them to reach out to, and law enforcement oftentimes turning a blind eye not only to the plights that these women are in, but also to their disappearances and murders. And if this is the case, Franklin's murder spree may in fact have begun long before his first known killing, which took place in 1977. Again, serial killers are notorious liars, and it is very possible that Franklin killed prostitutes before he went on his one-man mission to start a race war as a means to take out his frustrations and feed the thing inside of him that insisted he kill. Franklin, as with the majority of serial killers, was an opportunistic killer. And it's very possible that he began his actual killing with the murder of prostitutes and eventually changed his MO to targeting interracial couples, maybe hoping to control his desire to commit these horrendous acts. We're going to end the episode at this point in time, with the end of 1979 fast approaching and no end in sight for Joseph Paul Franklin and his killing spree. I hope that you guys have enjoyed this episode, and until next time, stay morbid!